There's a teaching of the Buddha that relates pretty directly to that phenomenon, that sense of anxiety or concern about wanting to take on or contemplate issues that are difficult or troubling, that I wanted to share a little bit tonight. First, in the classic terms that the Buddha first spoke of it in terms of his personal experience, and then how I think those teachings relate to applying our knowledge of Buddha Dharma and the maturation of our practice to working with social issues, whether it's the environment or something else. And it goes back to the sort of archetypic tale of how the Buddha decided to embark on the path to seek to enlighten himself, to become free of suffering, and to teach others to do so as well. And it said that, you know, he lived in a highborn family that ruled the little fiefdom where he lived, and that he, throughout the time of his growing up, led a very sheltered life, that he was well cared for, all of his needs were attended to, and he was very carefully shielded from the difficulties of life of the common person in the area of northeastern India where he lived. And that it was not until he was well into adulthood that he happened to go forth one day and for the first time fully encounter how hard life was for the general populace of his little kingdom that he was being groomed to lead. And it turns out, from what I've learned from linguists and historians of the, you know, the era, that was actually a fairly common practice insofar as training future leaders was concerned in these little kingdoms in northeastern India, which was they would raise them in the lap of luxury, and they would live very well, and they would enjoy all the technological advances of the time, and they would be well educated, trained to lead, in other words. And then at some point, sort of like kind of a shock treatment, they would expose them to the full range of difficulties experienced by the general populace where they lived. And it was for a couple of reasons. One, it was to reinforce the caste system, so that they, if they had any notions about doing something else for a living or going elsewhere, it's saying, you leave our compound and you leave your caste and you walk away from your responsibilities and this will be your fate. And then maybe also to take on some sense of responsibility as well for the people that they were going to be ruling over. Well, in the Buddha's case, it really sort of backfired. and that's also how they would tell whether somebody was getting ready to, was prepared to take on the mantle of leadership, or whether instead they were going to lead the holy life and abandon the robes of power altogether, or at least of temporal power. And so the way the Buddha describes his experience of first being exposed to these exigencies of life, that it came as a profound shock, and it had the experience of making him feel anxious and fearful and isolated and alone. And collective term in Pali that he used for that constellation of feelings is Samvega, S-A-M-V-E-G-A. And it was that feeling, that group of feelings, feeling afraid, isolated, alone, when he first encountered full on the reality of aging, the reality of illness, infirmity, of serious bodily injury, of trauma, and the reality of death. Because on his journey out of the compound with one of the provisioners from his palace is when he first encountered these things personally. He'd been very carefully hidden from anyone beyond a certain age was not permitted in the part of the compound where he lived. So it was a place of eternal youth. Okay. Anyone in the royal compound who felt ill was taken away somewhere else. Kind of like we do now, right? With, you know, somebody gets too bad off, you know, we stash them off in a nursing home or hospital. And then, of course, he came across a corpse being loaded onto the wagon to be carried up to the charnel grounds, right? Saw somebody dead. And actually, in the Buddhist tradition, those are referred to as the three heavenly messengers. Because they had a message that he was ready to hear. Okay. And then he also encountered somebody in robes, a monastic, you know, who seemed to be very much at peace with things as they were. And so he became aware of that possibility as well. So this sense of urgency, of alienation, of fear, of anxiety, in the time, you know, as he began to experience it more fully and really inquire into what its nature was, okay, and saw it in other people as well, and would talk to them about what it was that they feared and made them anxious. You know, at the time, this was a society that believed very fully in reincarnation, for instance. That was just their understanding of how things were. So in addition to the causes of concern I just mentioned, fear generated by the memory of past lives. Okay, in other words, memories of how I really blew it back then that I may pay for in this lifetime. Fear of future suffering. Okay, fear of future suffering of the body, and fear of payback for something I do in this lifetime that I may suffer the consequences of later on, or for that matter, fear of ways I may blow it in the future for which I'm gonna, you know, suffer the consequences. And fear created by struggle for survival in the present. Okay. Finding enough to eat, finding shelter, sustaining personal safety, sustaining oneself, you know, in this very time, this very body. So some of those things, as we can see, are kind of hardwired into the consciousness, aren't they? I mean, we wouldn't be here as a species if there weren't that kind of ambient anxiety about, you know, what do we need to do to take care of ourselves? And the Buddha also realized that taken to extreme, to stay in that state, you know, indefinitely, was unwholesome, it was painful, it was difficult. When he came back to his palace, to his compound, and spoke about his experience and how wrought up they had caused him to feel, then essentially his family and his, you know, courtesans and the members of the court and whatnot, they did everything they could to chill him out, you know. You know, come on, dude, kick back, have a brewski, you know. you know, play some video games or whatever they, you know, was however they amused themselves at the time. So doing whatever they could to distract him, to take his mind off what it was that was disturbing him. Even as some of us might find a tendency to do ourselves in this day and age, and even as does our whole culture, our whole society, you know, it's pretty much geared around denial of these things we don't like to look at. Knowing this to be the case, knowing on the one hand how disturbing he found these new experiences to be, but also realizing their value in terms of motivating him to inquire more deeply and to how to bring suffering to an end for himself and others, he saw there was great value in not allowing oneself to slip back into a state of denial, okay? Whether through distracting oneself with activities or drugs or alcohol or, you know, excessive consumption of comfort foods, whatever. He said it's really important that some degree of our consciousness stay focused on these things. Because what he said was, you know, aging, infirmity, injury, death, in and of themselves, they just come with the territory. Should have read the fine print before you took delivery on this thing, right? It's just how it is. What causes the pain or the difficulty is not the facts of those aspects of being in human life. It's the mind's reaction to them. And so when he went out to try to discover, you know, why do we suffer and how it can be brought to an end, that's the form of suffering he was interested in. Why is it that we're so resistant to simply acknowledging the truth of these things? And he discovered it's because, given the way the human mind works, when we fully let those truths in and fully acknowledge them, the reaction in our consciousness tends to be one of fear and anxiety and alienation and contraction and withdrawal. That there's something about the nature of the discursive mind that leads to the arising of those states of mind. And then he said, well, that being the case, how might we live at peace with these realities in a way that does not cause those states of mind to arise? And the first thing he recommended was a little bit like homeopathic medicine, where they give you a little bit of what it is that would otherwise make you ill so the body can build up a kind of a natural strength to overcome it, okay? Or like the little grain of sand in the oyster's belly that around which the pearl is generated. He said, because of the tendency to deny and bury and look the other way, and then he's to people who'd been practicing for a little while, wasn't the first thing he laid on them, but he said, it would actually really be a good idea if you set aside a little bit of time every day doing what he called the five daily recollections. Okay. And that is to begin your meditation by, you know, just quietly reflecting, reminding yourself silently, I am of a nature to grow older. I've not gotten beyond aging. I'm subject to illness and infirmity. I've not gotten beyond illness and infirmity. I am of a nature to die. I've not gotten beyond death. All that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. Okay. I am born of my karma. I am heir to my karma. My actions are the womb from which I have sprung. Okay. My actions are my relations. My actions are my protection. All that I do, both skillful and unskillful, wholesome and unwholesome, of these actions I shall become the heir. Doesn't exactly want to make it burst into song, does it? It's a little kind of edgy. You know, that's why he said what he taught was, he said, these teachings go against the grain, against the stream. Okay. They're not where the discursive mind naturally wants to go. Okay. Because the self-generated, or the self-generating mind, okay, the discursive mind that conceives of, that perpetuates the belief in a permanent and abiding self, is profoundly disturbed and insulted by the reality of aging, the reality of illness and infirmity and injury, the reality of death, okay, and doesn't want to acknowledge it. So the way to overcome that tendency toward avoidance, okay, because of the painful feelings that can arise, number one is to focus on a regular basis on the fact that these things are true, okay, and it's just how it is. And then to focus on any of the difficult feelings that might arise, because he found in the right setting, you know, just like, you know, when psychedelics were, you know, even more popular than they are today, people would talk about set and setting. If you're going to take some kind of a mind-altering substance, you need to be in a safe place, a place you trust, a place where there are others who, in the event you're in trouble, you start having a bad trip, you know, can be there for you, right? Well, to some extent, doing this practice is a mind-altering experience. And especially doing things like rattling off those five daily recollections, you know, that can have a tendency to put your head in a place you don't necessarily want it to go, right? So he said, if you're going to do this powerful practice, it needs to be done in the right setting. And that's where these teachings about the refuges came from. Taking refuge in your own Buddha nature. I take refuge in the Buddha and the wisdom and compassion that is part of our spiritual birthright, you know. Taking refuge in the Dharma, taking refuge in your own capacity to know that which is true. And also to develop some insight into the teachings that the Buddha offered on how to bring suffering to an end. And then taking refuge in Sangha, which is us. The importance of being with a community of like-minded people as you undertake these powerful and sometimes difficult practices. It's from doing that in that kind of a setting, right? In a setting of safety and support, that allows your own innate tendencies toward insight and toward compassion to come forth, that you begin to make the shift from this emphasis on sambhaga, the anxiety, the alienation, and the worry. What begins to happen is that that energy under the right set and setting in the place of refuge, trusting in your own capacity for self-healing, is that it begins to be transmuted into another state of mind that the Buddha referred to as pasada. Okay. Confident, calm, abiding. Which is to say, and it's kind of almost like a mathematical or a chemical formula, okay, that when there is the arising of the sambhaga, the sense of alienation, anxiety, worry, isolation, that it begins to naturally generate a sense of self-compassion. And you see these feelings that arise not so much as, wow, I'm really frightened, I'm really anxious, I feel really alone, to there is fear, there is anxiety. There is a sense of isolation. Okay, so like bubbles of swamp gas, they come to the surface and they pop, but they're happening within this great large field. Okay. And then what they actually begin to bring about then is this sense of self-compassion. Okay, that's not coming from a constructed sense of self. It's coming from somewhere else within the human spirit. It's coming from somewhere else within us. You know, it's what sometimes in the Mahayana especially is referred to as sometimes as like sea consciousness or alaya, that there lies within us not only the potential for these difficult feelings, but also for these very powerful positive feelings and abilities in the realm of self-care. It's almost as it's what Tara Brach, one of the teachers in this tradition, calls self-parenting. That when you begin to trust just a little bit in this capacity for self-healing and in the self-existent nature of compassion, that just as the difficult feelings arise, they kind of summon forth the ability of the human spirit to heal itself, to take care of ourselves as would a loving parent when the difficult times arrive. And then as that begins to happen more and more, as you spend more time with people who think, you know, whether or not they're deep into it in terms of, you know, ardent believers or have strong faith, but even to the point of saying, well, you know, you may have been on to something, you know. It's possibility, it's worth looking at together to inquire into whether or not maybe he was right. That maybe there is a place in the human heart-mind as well where that calm abiding is there, where it's been all along. Okay, and that capacity for self-love, and that capacity for compassion, which is the origin, the place from which it begins to be possible to be genuinely compassionate for others as well. Okay. So, generically speaking, that's this. These teachings come as a set, and the Buddha talked about Samvega as the very state of mind that I encountered and I experienced very forcefully, you know, when I first went forth and first got a full appreciation of what life is all about in terms of the range of suffering that it affords, you know, that's inevitable, it's going to come our way. And then what happened to my mind as a result, and then what happened after that when I began to discover the capacity for self-compassion and ultimately for others. He spoke in individual terms and thus coming together individually. As we were meeting yesterday afternoon, and as I have looked over the years in terms of my own experience and social movements and whatnot, with efforts to bring Buddha Dharma to bear on really pressing and painful social problems, I've seen a lot of parallels arise. So that just as it can be kind of tough for us to look at our own individual situation with regard to aging, infirmity, and death and whatnot, it can be just as painful to look at the condition of our society, of people who are suffering needlessly because of structural aspects of the society we live in, whether or not it's got to do with relations of between people of different ethnicities or the distribution of wealth and power in society, things that cause genuine, you know, searing, long-lasting pain, right, that need compassionate attention, our relationship with our environment. Okay. It could be a really powerful disinclination to look at that stuff, just like there is at the individual stuff, you know, aging, infirmity, and death. Okay. And so I think part of my personal path right now, and so far as trying to bring the voice of, you know, my own understanding of Buddha Dharma to bear on environmental stuff, you know, has got to do with trying to come from that same kind of place of compassion, you know, when I engage in discourse in these matters that I do with myself. You know, most of the people I know who are strongly resistant to the notion that, you know, as a species, we may be in the process of kind of boiling ourselves and the rest of the planet in oil. It isn't necessarily because they don't believe it to be true. Okay, the resistance to it, the sometimes, you know, powerful, almost violent resistance to those scientific teachings that are coming forth. It's because it evokes exactly the same kind of response, of psychological response, as the Buddha experienced in his first experience of Samvega. It's painful, and it's frightening, okay? And it's isolating and alienating, and it makes one feel like a sense of powerlessness or hopelessness, right? And for the same reasons, right? Because it's being taken in on a personal or an individual basis, rather than, wow, look what we're up against, okay? Look what we're experiencing. You know. What might we be able to do about it? Not from the traditional means of responding, denial, okay, right? Or doing things to avoid having to look at the difficult. And not to approach it in an adversarial way, but to see if it's possible to bring that same sense of compassionate open-heartedness, you know, the non-dual feeling, which is what actually in Buddha Dharma we try to cultivate in ourselves insofar as relationship to our own suffering individually is concerned, you know, okay. To try to cultivate that same sense of open-heartedness and non-aversiveness to the suffering that we see happening on a much broader scale, you know, whatever realm it may be in. So that's about where my thinking is right at the point, at this point in time, and I'd very much appreciate hearing yours. You know, anything that I may have said that may have sparked something, a question or a comment on your part, this would be a good time for me to hear. Please.
I appreciate what you said, how you extended it to sort of a dispassionate experience in general terms, in response to everyday things. I mean, my sense is that most people in this culture feel that, at least daily, just the dispassionate experience of life, being that more in competition with the people they encounter than in friendliness or, you know. It's just that edge I sense. And I don't know, it struck me when you put it in that term, in those terms, to think, well, actually, how about everyone at least, you know, a dozen times a day?
I from time to time, find myself, or over the most of my adult life, on occasion found myself feeling depressed. There's just been a state of depression that's arisen. And one of the aspects of it that I think makes it extra painful is that almost always when I found myself in a state of depression, it's always been accompanied by a feeling of loneliness, you know, of being cut off. You know, it's always been a comfort, at least for me personally, that somehow or another I'm the only one who's feeling this, you know. Or that if I'm not, it's kind of embarrassing and I don't want to talk to anyone else about feeling the way I feel. So it's not just, and that's one of the reasons that actually that, you know, back when I also took up playing the blues, because I find it very cathartic. You know, it's a kind of a socially acceptable way to discharge the feeling. No one wants to, it's like what I, the way I have it in my head is that, you know, no one wants to listen to you go on about, you know, how crappy you feel. But if you can do it in a melodic way that sounds good, people make serious money playing the blues, you know, but you got to do it in a way that they find attractive. But otherwise, there's this real tendency just to hold it in, just to not, which makes the feeling of isolation even worse. Mm-hmm. Feeling of being cut off, the feeling of hopelessness, feeling that no one cares. Okay, and it's by being in settings like this, it's by, you know, being able to generate a little compassion for ourselves, that it becomes possible to say, okay, well, if I'm feeling that, you know, at least from what the mental health people are telling us, is that from time to time, off and on, about 20% of the American public's feeling a significant state of depression. Sometimes it's situational, sometimes it's fleeting, sometimes it's the baseline state of their lives. But it's one of the more pernicious aspects of that mind state, and one of the first one that's important for me to remember. Self-generated.
So with that sense of helplessness, I often feel overwhelmed by sheer anger with society.
Yes.
For, you know, I don't know, is it 20 or 25% poverty in this country?
Yes.
I mean, to me, it is overwhelmingly anger-arousing. And I do not know what to do about it. Mm-hmm. And the loneliness and the isolation and the sadness.
Yes, yes.
It's really difficult.
Well, in terms of individual feelings, you know, it's working on just from an individual standpoint, there's a great little book called Self-Compassion. I highly recommend. I can pull up the author's name here if you're interested. When Joanna Macy, the social activist, writes about this stuff, you know, one of the things that she has in common with psychotherapists is starting off with the importance of acknowledging and naming and honoring those feelings. Because the tendency for us, generally speaking, when that happens is, you know, when you find yourself just feeling morally outraged by some particularly egregious example of living in the wealthiest nation in the world and having an infant mortality rate somewhere down around in a third world country, you know, because of the gross differences and access to medical care, and just all the things that are needed in order to lead a healthy life, right? That it's really important to honor the outrage and the anger and whatnot, and to understand that there are normal reaction to that if you're a sentient being. Okay, I think what happens for me sometimes, at any rate, is that I have this image of what a good Buddhist ought to be feeling at that moment in time, and because I'm feeling outrage and anger and whatnot, then I tend to have some kind of aversion to those very feelings. You know, I feel I shouldn't be feeling that way, you know, because I should be beyond that. You know, I should be more chill about it. I should be able to take it in without getting upset. No, the reality of the situation is, you know, my dharma in the moment is that I feel just like you were saying. You know, I feel the outrage and I feel the injustice of it, and I feel that sometimes I feel a little guilty for the fact that I'm actually quite privileged, you know, and that somehow I should be doing more than I am to get involved in trying to address issues of social injustice. It's all about the transmutation, I think, you know, just like Samvega to Pasada, okay. And it doesn't mean, oh, don't worry about it, just go sit. It's about really reflecting on, are there ways that I can convert that energy into some kind of constructive non-dual action? Okay. Is there some way that I can convert that state of mind to a point where I can act out of compassion instead of out of aversion or out of anger? Okay. And for me, that's kind of a necessary step, because then that makes it possible that whatever, you know, and in my particular realm right now, it's got more to do with environmental stuff than anything else. And environmental justice stuff. But I find that, and this includes in my own academic writing, you know, I tend to totally get on my high horse in my day job when I'm writing about stuff like this. And yet, from time to time, I can recognize that, you know, it's highly dualistic language, you know, and moral shaming is only going to get you so far. And that somehow or another, if it's possible to bring in some insight into how things got like they are, you know, and say, if as a society we really do want to get to a better place with regard to this, you know, then speaking in terms of what a more positive vision of how we might distribute goods and wealth, you know, and for what purpose might be, rather than simply condemning the status quo. There are plenty of people around to do that, which is not to say that it doesn't need to be done. It's just that if you're serious about applying Buddha Dharma to it, it doesn't need to be you doing it. You know, if you can find a voice that includes some degree of compassion for why we find ourselves in the situation we do right now, and then how to go forward from there, that's different. And so I think if you can find groups of people that are coming from that kind of place to plug your energy into, it's very beneficial. Yeah, please, Don.
Let me sort of muddy the waters here.
Oh, please do. It's one of the things you're best at, actually.
I'm going to tell you two little stories. One is, I remember asking a Theravada monk. He was a disciple of Bhante Ji's, an American disciple.
Yes.
I asked him, are you happy? And he said, well, I'm not unhappy. And then I was at, you know, I was teaching out at the Federal Pen, yeah. And one of our guests was a Tibetan lama who had been imprisoned by the Chinese.
Yep.
And I asked him, are you happy? And he said, yes. And I said, really happy or not unhappy? And he said, really happy. You know, there was a kind of joyfulness about it.
Yeah.
Despite his experience.
Yeah,
you know.
Okay.
Okay, story number two. Trungpa Rinpoche was invited to appear on one of those shows, I don't know, David Frost or one of those guys back during the Vietnam era, alongside a really determined anti-war activist. And the anti-war activist took him to task. She said, you know, how can you sit there and contemplate your navel when people are dying by the thousands in Vietnam as a result of our go-go?
Yeah.
And she just really ripped into him. And so he sat there and listened to the whole thing, and finally he said, so you can't be happy until the war ends. It was a very interesting reaction, wasn't it? Because where he's coming from is, he's saying to her, your happiness is entirely conditional. It's conditioned upon circumstances. If circumstances are favorable, you can be happy. If they're unfavorable, you can't. So I think, you know, taking a page from the Tibetan monk, it is possible to be really happy even in the face of injustice and so on, which is not to say that you ignore the injustice or don't do anything about it.
Right.
You absolutely do. But you're coming at it from the perspective of unconditional happiness.
How do you think it was that the Tibetan monk was able to truthfully say he's genuinely happy after having been tortured in a Chinese prison?
Well, from all the accounts that I've read of monks who have been tortured, you know, Tibetan lamas and so on, they are very scrupulous about not hating their torturers. That's the worst thing that could happen to them. Torture me all you want, but if I buy into it to the extent that I hate you or am angry at you, then I've really lost.
Wow.
That's where they're coming from. That's how unconditionally, you know, happy they are, if you will. You know, that's coming from an absolute perspective of selflessness, isn't it?
Very good. In a similar story I heard about Kenpo Rinpoche when he was dying. And those closest to him were gathered around his bedside in lamentation. He said, don't worry, nothing happens. Nobody home, nobody to die. You know, it's just, all that happens is this thing runs out of gas and that's it, you know. And I guess that, I guess to be able to truthfully say that someone was happy, they would have to have been living in that same state of emptiness. Nobody to torture.
Yeah.
Whoa.
I know, it's almost unfathomable. It's almost inconceivable to be in that such a state of transcendence, if you will.
Yeah. I don't know, I find myself quite inspired by stories like that, because it's one thing to read these words that the Buddha is thought to have said, you know, 2,500 years ago, and it's quite another to encounter people whose lived reality they are. Remarkable. Please.
Well, I've been to some teachings with the Dalai Lama, and he's just a very joyful guy.
Yes.
And if you look at the history of what he's been through, it's you know, with his close relatives being tortured and killed, etc. It's pretty remarkable. But I also think to myself, what is my propensity to be bothered? What is my propensity to be bothered?
To be bothered?
To be bothered by things.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Different things that occur in my life. So that's, I really take note of that, because are you willing to accept, you know, like a government that's sort of locked up, and, you know, the environment, and if you're not, then, you know, things and, you know, fights with people in my family, you know, just the usual stuff. If that's the case, and you're not willing to work with that, you know, you're not going to be happy.
Yes.
So.
Yes.
What would be the definition of happy?
That's coming right up, actually. Not tonight, but there, you know, I've been thinking about doing this more in-depth extended series on the Brahma Viharas, you know, the four immeasurables, compassion, equanimity, open-heartedness, and joy. And the Buddha actually spoke in terms of four different forms of happiness or joy. And the one that that I think Don and the monk and certainly the Dalai Lama and I will refer to as the fourth form, which is a combination of it's actually, it's called selfless joy. Okay. And when one feels it arise in oneself, it's called sukha, S-U-K-H-A. And then when it kind of flows forth and touches another, or when your heart is resonating with another's happiness, it's called mudita. Okay. It's an altruistic joy. Okay. It's a joy that's non-self-referential. And it's one that's felt when, basically, when most of the mind's energy is not taken up generating the self. Okay. Sort of a natural state that one can fall into in the absence of self. It just kind of comes with the territory. But it also is one of those, it's kind of like an endangered species, you know. It's not kind of running around all over the place, you know. It's not real prominent. The conditions need to be right for it to arise. And in this notion that, again, all you need to do is sit back and do nothing and everything's going to be fine, coming from that place of emptiness, nothing could be further from the truth. Because the practice of coming into a state of being able to realize no self doesn't mean that you stop being active in the world. That basically is the fuel source for the path of the bodhisattva, for the one whose life is in fact devoted to the alleviation of suffering, you know. Those monks in that prison, any one of them who wanted to could have disrobed and disavowed the Eightfold Path, and taken up the teachings of Chinese communism and walked free. The reason they were in jail is because they wouldn't, right? And yet they were in many ways freer than the people, mm-hmm. freer than their captors, freer than those who were torturing them. Yeah. So it's inspiring to know that that kind of happiness under those kinds of conditions is still a possibility. Yeah, please.
Just to add to your story, I had also heard that they were aware that their torturers were racking up so much terrible karma mm-hmm. by torturing them that they automatically responded by showering them with loving kindness mm-hmm. to try to, you know, not have them have so much bad karma, not add to their bad karma by hating them.
Yeah. 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 A lot of guards, you know, that do stuff like that. They do their best to spend the rest of their lives drunk, because if you ever fully awakened to what you've done, it'd be hard to live with yourself, you know. And those who do oftentimes go through very profound conversions and become dramatically different people than they had been before. Yeah.
I wanted to offer a teaching I heard at Spirit Rock, which always stuck with me and I think can be helpful when dealing with anger and outrage, these sorts of things. I can't remember who said it, but it's a great mind shift. And he said, sometimes it's useful to imagine that everybody else on the planet is enlightened and here for your benefit. So you can imagine that when somebody cuts you off in traffic or the perpetrators of ecocide, you know, maybe part of that is to give you the invitation to really sort of learn how to be with that and to attain the necessary distance from it, instead of getting captured and becoming hostage to it.
Yeah, Jack like used to one. Say that. He used to say, imagine it's the Buddha in drag.
Yeah.
Okay, let's settle in, folks. We've got to go our separate ways here. Let's spend just a minute sitting together in meditation once again. Live in joy and in health, though subject to affliction. Live in joy and in peace, even among those who are troubled. Live in joy and in love, even among those who hate. Look within, be still. Fear, free from fear and attachment. Know the sweet joy of the way.